Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
There's a major breakthrough today in Washington in the fierce battle over immigration reform. Let's go right to Nicole Gawet of the Los Angeles Times. She joins us from the U.S. Senate building. And Nicole, we know that earlier today, Democrats were unable to bring Arlen Specter's bipartisan Senate Judiciary Bill on immigration reform to a vote. But we also know that last night a new bill was hashed out. It seemed to have some support. So what's happening now?
Well, Robin, just minutes ago, the vote to end debate on Chairman Specter's bill, which would have given undocumented immigrants a pathway to citizenship, it lost. So debate is going to continue on that bill, but senators gathered to announce a breakthrough on an amendment to that bill. It's a measure that would tweak that bill slightly, and it addresses the way the undocumented here would be treated. It basically breaks them down into three groups, and how they will be treated depends on how long they've been here.
Now, is this, I just want to ask you, Nicole, is this the bill that was put forth by Republican Senators Mel Martinez and Chuck Hagel?
That's right, yes.
Okay. All right, well, tell us more.
Well, they've set up a system where undocumented immigrants who have been here for more than 5 years, and that's a group that's estimated about 7 million people, would be able to stay in the country and work towards citizenship. They would have to pay back taxes and a fine. They would have to learn to speak English or at least demonstrate fluency and take civics courses, a number of things like that. The people who have been here for less than 2 years, basically who arrived since January 2004, would have to leave. It's the middle group that is slightly more complicated. These are people who have been here from 2 to 5 years. They're an estimated 3 million. They would be given temporary work visas. They would have to register within 6 months, and they would have 3 years on this temporary work visa in which they could apply for actually, I have to start again. It's quite complicated.
It sounds it.
They would have 3 years to file paperwork for a temporary visa, which they would have to pick up at an official point of entry outside the United States. So they would have to touch their toe somewhere outside the states, in Mexico and Canada, pick up that visa, come back in. Once they re-entered the states on this visa, then they could apply for a green card. But there will only be a limited number of green cards available, and probably not nearly enough for the estimated 3 million people in this group.
We're talking to Nicole Gawet of the Los Angeles Times as apparently a major breakthrough in Washington over immigration reform. And we mentioned Arlen Specter's Senate Judiciary bipartisan bill, which was considered by many opponents to be too light on illegal immigrants. And now this new proposal that's been put forth that might perhaps toughen it up a bit. We want to hear what Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist has to say about this. He, of course, has been very critical of Arlen Specter's bill. Let's listen.
I believe that the Hagel-Martinez proposal pays attention to the 9/11 recommendations. It respects the rule of law as well as that rich contribution and heritage provided by our immigrant population.
So, Nicole, again, Bill Frist had been one of the ones, you know, most skeptical of the bill. This sounds as if he's endorsing the idea of the proposal being, you know, the proposal from Mel Martinez and Chuck Hagel being attached to the bill.
Yes, it does. I mean, it does provide Frist a way out, a way to save face. He had pressured the Judiciary Committee to come up with the bill. They did it against expectations, and they produced a bill that was not like Frist's enforcement-only bill. And he's been he's had to find a way to sort of reclaim leadership of this and save face, and this gives him away. It's a Republican amendment. It doesn't give all 12 million a path to citizenship. It just gives some of them.
Right. Well, I just want to say Senator John McCain of Arizona said he's been assured that President Bush supports this new measure and would say so publicly later today, but he's the president being criticized by Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid. Let's listen.
Where is President Bush? I haven't seen the vice president over in his little office here calling people in saying this is what we need to do for the country. I would hope that the president would join in the move to pass important immigration legislation.
Nicole Gallwett, what is the thinking on the floor? Is this something that is going to pass? Is this, you know, the most civil it would seem that this debate has been in a long time?
It certainly does seem to have improved cooperation, and the senators in this press conference were very upbeat about their chances and about this new unity. But they also warned that they were very worried about further attempts to amend the bill in ways that would, in Senator McCain's words, gut it. And they also spoke about their worries about what will happen in conference when the Senate bill is sort of combined with the House bill, which is a very tough enforcement-only bill. And House Republicans especially have made clear that they are not at all interested in any guest worker provisions or any provision that would give citizenship to undocumented immigrants here.
Nicole Gallwett of the Los Angeles Times on a breakthrough in Washington on immigration reform, but as she notes, a long way to go. Nicole, thanks so much. That was Nicole. Well, yesterday we reported on a health plan reform here in Massachusetts being closely watched by other states. Today we want to spend some time on what Massachusetts and other states are trying to do. 48 million Americans don't have health insurance. Of these, 6 million lost their health coverage in the last 4 years. And while polls show that Americans want health care reform, they disagree on how to get there. Well, with that in mind, Massachusetts' groundbreaking plan to require that all residents have health insurance of some kind or be fined is providing fodder for debate already underway in many states, such as Oregon, Arizona, California, and New Mexico, where lawmakers are mulling over proposals to create universal health coverage for all residents. We'll have more on that in a minute. But first, as we said, the Massachusetts bill would require that all residents have health insurance, and if they or their employers don't buy it, they'll each be fined. But with insurance for a family costing $11,000 a year, how will people pay for it? Joining us first on the line is John McDonough, Executive Director of the group Healthcare for All in Massachusetts. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And we know, as the name of your group indicates, you're an advocate of universal health care, and you've been quoted praising Massachusetts' plan, but you've also been quoted as saying this is one sticking point. How do people pay for it? Is that a concern?
Well, it's a concern. I think that the national reports saying that this law is going to require everybody to have health insurance is overstated. What the law states is that everyone who is able to afford it, everyone for whom affordable coverage is available, will be required to have it or else will face some kind of penalty. The definition of affordable is not written into the law, and that's yet to be defined into the regulatory process. And so while this is a very good law, it's particularly good for folks in lower income range and the lower middle income range, it is going to be less helpful to folks who don't have health insurance who are in the more middle income range. And it is not our expectation that they are going to be fined or mandated to actually purchase coverage which is not going to be affordable to them.
And the state is trying to come up with ways to solve this problem. We should say, as you have indicated, the state plans to enlarge its Medicaid coverage so that more people get Medicaid help. It also plans to subsidize those who are very poor. But according to all sorts of scales, that leaves about 200,000 people who will be on their own to pay the full cost. And what are the moves being made to sort of make the insurance affordable to them?
Well, there are a host of other reforms that we think should help to make insurance more affordable for some of those folks. For example, part of the bill is going to merge the small group market, the market for small businesses, with the market for individuals right now, and that should result in a reduction in premiums for folks who need to get it on their own of about 25% from where it is right now. There'll also be ways for folks who can't get it now to be able to get coverage at a pre-tax basis. Whether these and other things will actually lead to coverage being genuinely affordable is not demonstrated or proven yet, and unless they can do that, folks are not, in fact, going to be mandated to buy coverage.
Well, today's Boston Globe reports that Governor Mitt Romney wanted health plans for this group of uninsured to be in the $200 a month range. And the newspaper reports today say that instead it's going to be in about the $325 a month range for individuals, twice that for families, you know, $600 or so a month. That's a lot of money and not that much different than what is currently available to the uninsured in Massachusetts. So obviously there's work to be done.
We never believed for a moment Governor Romney's assertion that we would get reasonable plans down to around $200.
And by the way, John, I just want to interrupt for a second to ask, how was that going to happen? I mean, is this by putting pressure on insurance companies, by what, legislating?
No, actually, the secret in the governor's plan was $200 premiums with deductibles built into the plans at levels as high as over $10,000 for a family.
Well, but still, some would say, well, that's not a win for the insured because those deductibles are so high.
That's right. And the legislature rejected that approach and built in deductibles and other kinds of cost sharing at much more affordable levels.
So the state was trying to legislate what the deductibles and what the premiums are.
Yeah, they put in much more reasonable deductible levels than what the governor had envisioned.
But still, you know, it right now is at a place that's, as we said, not much different than what's currently available.
Well, we'll see. There's a long road ahead in terms of the innovation and the experimentation here. If we can provide coverage on a pre-tax basis, if we can do some of the other reforms, then we think it should create more affordable products. Whether it's enough to help that group in the middle is the big unanswered question, and we don't know that, and we won't know that for a little while.
John McDonough of Healthcare for All in Massachusetts, can you just comment on statistics from the governor's office that when they studied the roles of the uninsured, they expected to find single mothers? And when we hear this debate across the United States, we're going to hear more about that in a moment, most people say that is the largest bulk of the uninsured. But in Massachusetts, the governor's office claims that instead they found a majority of the uninsured are young white men who can afford it but just don't want to buy it.
I think that conclusion is a little misleading. Young adults in their 20s are much more likely not to have health insurance than everyone else. But the population of uninsured people in Massachusetts and around the country is a very diverse group of people. And to suggest that it's all young white men is really missing the point.
John McDonough, Executive Director of the group Healthcare for All in Massachusetts. I know you've got a dash to catch a plane. John, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And coming up, what other states are taking away from the Massachusetts model and some of their solutions as well? And we want to report this news to you. It's now being reported that Vice President Dick Cheney's former top aide, Scooter Libby, told prosecutors that President Bush authorized the leak of sensitive information about Iraq, according to new court documents filed by prosecutors in the Valerie Plame CIA leak case. Before his indictment, Louis Scooter Libby testified to the grand jury investigating the Valerie Plame leak that Cheney told him to pass on the information and that it was Bush who authorized the leak, the court papers say. And according to the documents, the authorization led to the conversation between Libby and New York Times reporter Judith Miller on July 8, 2003. There was no indication in this filing that either Bush or Cheney authorized Libby to disclose Plame's CIA identity. Much more coming up on this and other news here and now. Now back with more on our look at the groundbreaking measure in Massachusetts to expand health insurance coverage. It's about to become law and may become a model for other states. Starting in 2007, all residents of Massachusetts would be required to have health insurance. If they absolutely can't afford it, the state will help out. If the state determines they can afford it and they choose not to buy insurance, they will lose some of their tax returns. And there will also be fines for businesses with 11 or more employees that don't provide health benefits. So everyone, businesses, government, citizens, kicks in a little bit to ensure that more people will be insured. But will it work? Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Alice Burton of the Health Policy Research Group, Academy Health, where she is also director of the State Coverage Initiative Program. And Alice, your thoughts after hearing our previous guest, John McDonough of Healthcare for All in Massachusetts. Now, as he notes, the poor get help, the wealthy get a warning. But what about people in the middle whose employees may choose a fine rather than cover them? And so they're slammed with the fact that they can't afford this insurance. Where's this money going to come from?
Ah, that's the key question in all of this discussion about affordability and how the changes in Massachusetts will really make these policies more affordable for individuals to be required to purchase them. I mean, let me step back a little bit and say there are several things that the state is doing to finance and expand coverage. They are expanding the Medicaid program, which will make it certainly more affordable for very low-income families to have insurance. And there are these changes that John spoke very clearly about in the small group market and the individual market, which hopefully will make policies more affordable for individuals.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another untried element in the Massachusetts proposal, the concept of the insurance connector. It's a new state agency?
That's my understanding, a new state agency to connect both individuals and small employers to the purchase of insurance.
And this is, you know, it's putting another layer in the government, and some would say that's unusual. What are you hearing across the country? It sounds as if even people who don't want to see the government adding more layers are pushing for this.
Yeah, I think there's actually a lot of interest across the country in the notion that we should streamline access to insurance coverage for individuals and small employers, that there already is a lot of structure and a lot of process to go about to purchase insurance. And for a small firm that may have a few employees and not a big human resources office, there is certainly an attractive element to think that they might be able to rely on an insurance connector or some type of agency that really helps them to connect them to insurance.
Well, let's take a look at what some other states are doing. We know Illinois voted last year to insure all children. Kansas, Maine, and Minnesota are among the states trying to help small businesses buy insurance. But just give us some sense of other approaches that states are taking.
Yeah, well, I do point to the Illinois proposal because I think while they've expanded coverage for children and will do that in July, that's sort of a historic. They're building on that over a number of years. A number of states have seen that and picked that same concept up, and at least in their discussions about what they're proposing to do. So several states have talked about an all-kids type program in their state following the Illinois model.
Well, how does it work? I mean, who pays for it? Where does that money come from?
For the most part, a lot of that is building on what is already in place in terms of the state's SCHIP program, which is a state and federally financed program that subsidizes coverage for children and families, you know, typically up to about two times the poverty level, so in families of about $40,000. The notion with all kids and what other states are saying is, let's not make the cutoff so severe. Let's not make it so that as soon as you're over that income level, you're not able to access insurance, because certainly there are a number of children and families above that income level that can't access insurance. So let's, on a sliding scale basis, allow families to purchase into that program. So that the financing for that would be a partnership between the family contributing to the cost of that insurance on a sliding scale basis and the state and federal government.
Right. And then that's reflecting what Massachusetts is doing, which is asking more from the individual, but yet also getting some from the government and some from businesses.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Maryland recently passed a law requiring large companies with employees of over 10,000 employees to provide health insurance. They were widely seen as targeting Walmart. Here in Massachusetts, there's different kinds of proposals regarding businesses. How do you see a large business like Walmart, that many people say isn't fairly paying its share of health care, how do you see that impacted by some of the new legislation?
Maryland and Massachusetts have approached this employer mandate question in very different ways. Maryland taking this fair share approach and really targeting very large employers. And yes, as a practical matter, only Walmart is really affected by the legislation in this year. But Massachusetts takes a very different approach to an employer mandate, really applying to virtually all employers, those over 10 or 11, which is quite a larger segment of the employer base, and also a larger part of where the problem is with small firms not offering insurance. The question is how much of a mandate exists in the Massachusetts legislation, and that will, I think, need to play out and see how that how that $295 incentive or requirement really plays out.
We should explain that here in Massachusetts, the new law would require, as you said, employers with 10 or more employees to pay a $200-some-odd fine per employee per year for every employee they don't insure. As it was explained to us, the thinking is, well, they're probably not going to insure them anyway, but at least the state gets some money from them to put back into the pot to subsidize the uninsured.
Yeah, and in that way, it's actually very much, it's similar in concept to the Walmart legislation, which is this notion that employers should pay their fair share, that there should be some contribution to the cost of the uninsured.
Well, Alice, what do you think is ultimately going to happen with, you know, perhaps different, you know, 50 different health care plans in 50 different states?
Well, I hope that it leads to a really a national solution, because I think the reality is that for individual states to really affect and make change in this area, it is limited. I mean, Massachusetts is clearly out there as a lead, and I think that states will, and national leaders will look to it to see what happens. But I think the real kind of systematic reform that really truly addresses healthcare costs, that addresses the number of the uninsured that we have, really probably has to come from a national model. My hope is that 50 different approaches will be pilots and lessons and experiences that Washington leaders can really learn from.
Alice Burton, Vice President and Director of the State Coverage Initiative Program at Academy Health, a Washington, D.C.-based health policy research group. Alice, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR.
50-year-old male found in the park, full arrest.
One, two, three!
Large laugh to the occipital scalp.
The fictional ER is one thing, but what would you want to do if a loved one were clinging to life in a hospital emergency room? Would you want to be there, in the ER, as doctors try to resuscitate your friend or relative? It can get ugly. Clothes are cut off, rib cages cracked open. Resuscitation more often fails than succeeds. But it might be the last chance you have to comfort your loved one. Well, a growing number of hospitals is allowing what's become known as family presence in the ER, but not everyone is happy about it. Joining us on the line is Dr. Jerome Groopman, who recently wrote about this debate over allowing family members in the ER for the New Yorker magazine, where he's a staff writer. He's also chief of experimental medicine at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center here in Boston. And Dr. Groopman, put this in context, as you do in your article, when you remind us that emergency rooms are very recent inventions.
Very recent inventions. They used to be called accident rooms, and it was only really after the Second World War that they came into their own, when there were major migrations into the cities and physicians no longer cared for emergencies in their offices.
Well, so because of this, we have this new question. Who should be allowed in when emergency medicine is being applied? And there's this new trend of family presence that you write about. When did that start, and how widespread is that?
That started about 20 years ago in a very dramatic way. A state trooper had been shot in rural Michigan, and he was rushed to the hospital. And his wife, who came shortly thereafter to the ER, along with a phalanx of other troopers, demanded to be with him. And the chaplain on call asked the doctors, and the doctors didn't want to allow family presence. But they were intimidated because of all these troopers in their blue uniforms. And this chaplain took this up as his cause.
And the woman was allowed in. And Dr. Groopman, we want to make clear again that we're just talking about patients who are being resuscitated. We're not talking about patients who are dying, because you have a different set of thoughts on that.
Yeah, very much so. I think that for someone who's dying and the death is expected, it's so important that friends, loved ones be there. This is different. This is someone who comes in urgently to the emergency room, and the doctors are desperately trying to save the person's life with all sorts of very often gruesome kinds of procedures.
Right. And you write further that people's view of what happens in the ER has lately been informed by these popular television shows like ER, so different from the old doctor shows from the 60s and 70s. Do they have false expectations of what's going to happen in there?
They very much have false expectations. ER and Chicago Hope and the other programs, House MD now, don't really represent what's going on. A study showed that 70% of the resuscitations on television are successful, and in two seasons of ER, there was only one complication, while in fact, only about 5 to at best 15% of resuscitations succeed, meaning the vast majority of people die, and the survivors are often left severely impaired, neurologically impaired.
And the family members that watch this can be traumatized by seeing it. You tell the story of a woman from East Boston here in this area who rode in the ambulance to the hospital and went into the ER with her father-in-law after he collapsed from a heart attack. And she was very upset by a look on his face. Tell us more about that.
Well, it's interesting because she had what I think is the usual experience, which was a mixed experience. She wanted to be with her father-in-law. She felt that it's a terrible thing, as she put it, to die alone. So she wanted to accompany him in the midst of this resuscitation. But on the other hand, as the intern was pressing on her father-in-law's chest, his eyes were bulging out. That's how she perceived it. Mm. And later, all she could think about was this image of these bulging eyes, and it came to haunt her.
But on the other hand, would she have chosen not to be there?
No, she wanted to be there, and it was important for her, she said, to be there. But I think this also shows that although this practice now exists within about 50% of the hospitals in the United States, it has not been studied in real depth psychologically with regard to both its risks and its benefits.
What do we know, though? It's largely anecdotal, but what do we know about people's wanting to be there when a loved one is being resuscitated and perhaps it doesn't work?
Well, we know from surveys that only about half of the people who had this experience of family presence respond to the survey. So half the people, we don't have any information. Those who respond say that overall, even if it were traumatic, they were glad they were there.
But on the other hand, there's another survey that we thought was interesting of nurses and doctors. How did doctors feel about family being there?
The doctors were very much opposed, particularly surgeons. 98% of trauma surgeons were against it. And here the argument is that they worry this can impair the success of their clinical care, because if they're distracted, either because of the activity of a family member breaking down and crying or crying out, or if they just are distracted knowing that someone's there.
Yeah, the pressure.
The pressure. They may not be able to act with that split-second timing that can make the difference between life and death.
Mm. But nurses, on the other hand, would want people there.
About half the nurses do. Most of the emergency nurses are in favor of this because they believe that it's an important emotional component for the family.
Well, so Dr. Grubman, what should people do if their hospital doesn't allow them to come in to see a loved one resuscitated? Do they have any recourse?
Well, I think they can certainly ask, and what usually happens is an accommodation is made that they will allow the person to come in after the most gruesome procedures are completed to say goodbye. On the other hand, I spoke to people who went to hospitals where this was policy, was allowed. They very much wanted to be there, and afterwards they found it so awful that they regretted it.
And how do you feel?
I'm of a mixed mind, and that's why I wrote this article the way I did. I feel there are arguments pro and con on each side, and what I think is crying out here is more knowledge and more research about what the impact this has on families and how best to do it if we're going to go forward.
Dr. Jerome Grubman is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His article on families in the emergency room as family members are resuscitated appears in last week's issue of the magazine. Dr. Grubman is also chief of experimental medicine at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center here in Boston. And still to come, the art of justice. How do courtroom artists do their job, especially with family members breathing down their necks? You're listening to Here and Now. Scientists say they may have found the missing link that documents the moment when fish first crept out of the water and walked on land. Researchers this week have discovered a fossil of a fish with limbs in the Canadian Arctic. And some scientists say it's possible that this walking fish could be an ancestor of us all. Here now's Alan Cockle has more.
Ferris Jenkins is a tall, dapper man. His once ginger hair and mustache are now mostly gray. When Jenkins goes looking for fossils in the Canadian Arctic, he carries only a walking stick and a rifle to protect against polar bears. 2 years ago, the Harvard paleontologist was working with colleagues on Ellesmere Island, just 900 miles from the North Pole.
Steve Gacy was working next to me, and I looked over and I said, "Steve, look at that. You just uncovered something that looks like a pair of mandibles, a pair of lower jaws. That might be a skull. You might have the whole thing." So we both went in after it.
They dug with picks and chisels. They knew it was a 370-million-year-old fish, but only back in the lab did the fossil begin to emerge from the rock.
What we have here is a model of the animal itself. And I've got a series of casts of the original material, including the skull.
The fiberglass model on Jenkins' desk looks like a salamander crossed with a crocodile. It's several feet long with a broad, flat head and a snout full of sharp teeth. That snout is important because it resembles the early tetrapods, the first four-legged animals. But this is a fish, albeit a fish with arm and wrist bones like ours, and bones similar to fingers.
And here's one of the fins as we found it.
Wow.
See, still covered with scales, but here there's the humerus, the radius, the ulna.
Jenkins picks up a plastic cast of the fossil to show how the animal might have walked.
What the skeleton of the fin really shows is that it was extremely robust and capable of flexing at the elbow, like this, and extending at the wrists. In other words, it could use the fins as a prop for the body.
Would it walk a little bit like a seal walks on its
feet? I imagine that's a good analogy.
And there was more. Over several months, Jenkins and his team gradually stripped away the rock to reveal more of the animal's skeleton.
We would get together and look at what the preparators had most recently uncovered. And, you know, there was one marvel after another marvel. And we got even more excited. And then when we wrote the paper, it wasn't three scientists deliberating in solemn discussion. No, no, no. We were just yelling at each other because it's so exciting.
They found that like four-legged creatures, but unlike other fish, this fossil has a neck. It also has interlocking ribs, which would provide rigid support for the torso. That's something that a purely aquatic creature likely wouldn't need. The report of the fossil in this week's issue of Nature describes a fish that walked on its fins and fed in the warm, shallow water along the banks of a meandering river. The fossil has been named Tiktaalik, the Inuit word for large, shallow water fish.
The fossil is an extremely important find.
Cliff Tabin is one of many scientists impressed by Tiktaalik. He studies limb development at Harvard Medical School and says the fossil will change how biologists think about the evolution of land animals. But he calls the fossil a cousin, not a direct ancestor of modern animals.
The way those digits are put together, the way that the hand is put together, it's not really on the road to making our version of a limb, but it is nonetheless making a legitimate limb with legitimate fingers and toes.
Back in his office, Jenkins disagrees. He calls Tiktaalik a classic missing link. So do you think that anything living today might be descended from this?
Oh, sir. All of it. All living tetrapods. You, me, your spouse and mine.
And one final note. Just as the scientists were preparing to leave their Arctic camp 2 years ago, they made another discovery. The fresh tracks of a giant polar bear, not 60 feet from where they'd been sleeping. Slightly unnerved, they still took time to make a plaster cast of one of those great paws. Perhaps that bear was a direct descendant of the walking fish they'd just discovered.
Here now is Alan Cockle. Well, to see the fossil of the walking fish for yourself, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. As a courtroom artist for both the New York Times and WABC in New York, Marilyn Church has had a front row seat at some of the most infamous trials of the last 30 years. Allowed in when cameras aren't, she provides a window into the prosecutions of John Lennon's killer Mark David Chapman, the so-called preppy murderer Robert Chambers, or the infamous case of the rape of the Central Park jogger. Well, now drawings from some of these trials have been collected in a new book. It's called The Art of Justice, An Eyewitness View of 30 Infamous Trials. And Marilyn Church joins us from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And we're also joined by your co-author, Lou Young, a longtime reporter for WCBS-TV in New York. Lou, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be here.
And Lou, we understand that in New York, cameras in the courtroom are rare. So, Marilyn, in many ways, with your eyes, a way to illustrate your stories.
Yeah, it was strange because we approached the use of courtroom art with a little ambivalence. It wasn't our first choice. We wanted cameras. And I started working with Marilyn over a 9-year period on these cases where cameras were denied. And at first I felt I was missing something. But in the long run, I ended up gaining something, which was a reporting partner and a unique view of the courtroom.
Sometimes, a moment frozen in a drawing is so much more effective than the courtroom video we've become used to up here, at least in Massachusetts and in other parts of the country. Let's talk about some of the trials in the book. I want to start at the Central Park jogger case. This is the 28-year-old woman who was found raped, nearly beaten to death in Central Park. It was difficult for you, I'd imagine, because you couldn't identify the woman, for instance.
As a matter of fact, the day we drew that trial, the artists were not even allowed to have art supplies in the courtroom. We had to sit and watch and memorize and figure out a way to portray her without showing her likeness and yet give the story of what happened.
And you remind us, there were several young men charged with this attack. They'd been roving gang attacks in Central Park at the time, something called wilding. Some had confessed. But you remind us in one of your perspectives that you interact with the families of the defendants in many cases, and you did in this case.
Yes. The mothers were so insistent that they were innocent, and they would cry out in court, and sometimes they would approach me afterwards and say, please, draw my son as he's innocent. That's so important to us. He never did this.
And your response and your thoughts?
And my response was, listening to the testimony was turning my stomach. And their demeanor in court also, they hid their faces or they kind of sneered at people. They didn't have a sympathetic look. But years later, I felt so terrible about the way I had portrayed them because they were eventually found innocent only after they had served their sentences. And they were freed, and I regretted the way that I didn't look at them more sympathetically.
Well, how big a role do your emotions play? I'm looking now at the so-called preppy murder trial. This is Robert Chambers accused of murdering a young friend in Central Park. You write, you identified with both the victim and the defendant.
That's true. I had a son in a school on the Upper East Side at the time, a teenager who could have known Jennifer Levin or been friends with her friends.
She was the victim.
And we were also in Central Park all the time. It was right outside our apartment.
When you have a tug and you're covering a trial, do you find your hand and your pen looking to make them a little more sympathetic, or if the opposite is true, make them a little more harsh? I mean, is that something you have to guard against?
Well, I think I, like anybody else, I absorb the testimony that I'm listening to. And when, you know, it's the gruesome details of this assault, it just eats away at me, and especially the age of this victim. I really had nightmares. Looking over at Chambers, I saw not a shred of remorse on his face. I just saw this kind of insolent arrogance in his face, and it made me search for the way to portray those emotions I saw.
Marilyn got to his essence, I think, because in photographs, Robert Chambers is a very handsome young man and almost a matinee quality face. But Marilyn was able to look past that, and young Robert even drove her to put down the pencils and get out the watercolors for this one trial because she wanted to get the flesh tones right, and she did it. The pictures of Robert Chambers in the book are much closer to the reality than the photographs you will see of him. And looking at them decades later, she really, really got to his soul, I guess you could say.
Yeah. I'm looking at some of the others. Amy Fisher, the Long Island Lolita, you write, you tried to capture that she just looked ashamed and humiliated and bewildered. And Woody Allen on the stand in his case with Mia Farrow telegraphed nothing in his face. Lou Young, I mean, a writer who covering trials, I know you're watching the faces, too, to see if anyone telegraphs anything. But I'm imagining there are things that you just can't say as well as Marilyn can draw them.
That's absolutely correct. And Marilyn sees things differently than I do, because we're two different people. So it's good to have another set of eyes on it. And sometimes, even recently, we covered a trial for WCBS. It was a first appearance in court, and I hadn't seen the defendant in 7 years. And he came in for this murder trial, and I thought he looked one way, and Marilyn thought he looked another. And mm-hmm. when I went back and looked at him a second time, she got to his look better than I did just looking at him in court. So the audience in that respect was fortunate not to have to just rely on my memory. And we have had discussions over the course of the years about how people look sometimes. I might disagree, but generally she's a lot better at it than I am.
Marilyn,
I hope so.
Marilyn, is there one, you know, is there a moment that you captured that either touches you or repels you, or, you know, is there an image that comes to you now?
One of my favorite images in the book is the Son of Sam case.
Oh, yeah.
Where he just explodes in the courtroom listening. That's David Berkowitz. He hears demons talking to him, and he just, in about 60 seconds, he's screaming and yelling at the top of his lungs, and court officers are rushing over and restraining him. And it's a scene that has to be memorized to be drawn, but it's you know, you wait in court. Court can be very dull visually, and it's really up to the artist to make it exciting, but a scene like that makes itself.
And you have to be ready for it. Everybody else is saying what
yes.
happened, and you are memorizing.
Yeah. Right. You have to anticipate anything, and your eyes have to be moving around the courtroom every minute, you know, making sure you don't miss something that's about to happen.
And start with the most important aspects of the picture. Sometimes these pictures were literally, and I can testify to this, taken out of her hand for deadline because
yes.
they weren't finished, and to her satisfaction. But we needed to go on the air. So you'll see some of these drawings where people aren't completely filled in on the periphery because they weren't finished, but there was no time to polish it up. And decades later, again, it stands as a document not only to the event but to the deadline pressure and the rush to get on the air, get the news out.
That's Lou Young with Marilyn Church. He is co-author of the new book, The Art of Justice, An Eyewitness View of 30 Infamous Trials. For more information and to see some of the artwork, don't forget, go to our website, here-now.org. Thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Oh, you're welcome, Robin.
And Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlott, Get Well Alex, Tara Murphy, and Virginia Prescott. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns, Molly Hamill and Daniel Estrin. The senior producer of Here Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.